Whether overt or unintentional, whether human or technology-oriented, bias is something that every company must be vigilant about. And while it used to be something you might have to worry about with your employees, today it can be equally pervasive and problematic in the algorithms those employees create. For a real-life example, you don't have to look any further than online lending. Researchers at the University of California recently discovered that online lenders' algorithmic credit scoring using big data regularly discriminates against Black and Latino borrowers by charging them higher interest rates. This is why trust has become such an important focal point here at Georgian Partners. And while the examples of bias in AI are numerous, one of the more prominent areas where we've seen it happen in recent years is in image processing. Today, we're lucky to have Timnit Jebru with us to talk about that. Timnit is a research scientist in the ethical AI team at Google AI and a co-founder of the group Black in AI, where she works to both increase diversity in the field and reduce the impact of racial bias in data. She was previously a postdoctoral researcher at the FATE group, that's Fairness, Accountability, Transparency, and Ethics at Microsoft Research in New York. She has some fantastic insights to share, so stick around. I'm John Pryle, and welcome to the Georgian Impact Podcast. Timnit, what a pleasure to have you. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
So, look, I've read about this. I think everybody read about this. This goes back to mid-2015. And the crisis of the day was that Google image recognition was identifying African Americans as gorillas. And it just went wild. Now, we understand sort of what's coming, but why don't you tell us really what was happening and what went on with that?
So a couple of people, well, I think it was one person, tweeted about the fact that Google Photos was identifying pictures of, I forget whether it was just his girlfriend or him and his girlfriend, as gorillas. So later on, I remember an engineer who used to be at Google, Jonathan, he wrote a blog post explaining what happened. And basically that a lot of Black people were being many times misidentified as gorillas, but also a lot of white people were also being misidentified as whales.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. So, but what's really important to note here is that we have to pay attention to the types of errors our models are making and not just the accuracy, right? So you can have 99% accuracy, but even on Black people, if you mistake them for a different person or if you mistake them for, you know, I don't know, some other thing, it might be okay. But gorillas, anybody who has a societal understanding of what Black people have been through would know that it is associated with many racist remarks, right? So there's remarks of comparing Obama to monkeys, Michelle Obama to monkeys and things like this. And this is a longstanding thing that has happened in the United States. So I think for me, this highlights that we have to pay attention to the types of errors we're making.
Right. So there's really two pieces of the type of error. One is just an error that turns out to be egregious. The other error is if I can classify and get a 98% accuracy, and this goes back to your gendershades.org work, if I get a very high accuracy on lighter skinned males and a much lower accuracy on darker skinned females, that's a different type of error rate, but that would also cause some serious challenges in terms of what I'm trying to do with this system, right?
Yes, exactly. So there's two pieces of what I'm trying to say. One is if you have a particular data set and you train, you test whatever model you train on that data set and you say, you know, you got 99% accuracy, you want to say where that 99% accuracy comes from, where that error comes from. Is it that it is completely accurate in certain segments of the population and completely inaccurate in other segments of the population? So this shows the importance of disaggregating these accuracy numbers by subgroups and also having more representative benchmarks that are not completely homogeneous. The second point I wanted to make was that even if you are 99% accurate on darker skinned females, the types of errors you make on that 1% is very important. So the fact that the error was mistaking people for gorillas, specifically Black people for guerrillas versus something else, that's very significant because of the historical ways in which Black people have been talked about, mm-hmm. right? And that societal ways. And that's why it's really important to have these kinds of understandings. It's not just about having high accuracy. It's also about being sensitive to the types of errors you might be making and how that could affect people.
Now, does that go back and having that error going back to the trainings? And this could be my naivety. I'm just sort of guessing here in terms of a solution. But there was a lot of work with Google image recognition. And we, the very first, in my mind, good example of supervised learning was they took animals and they organized them by cats and dogs. And then we just needed a human to label those 10 million were cats, those 10 million were dogs, and they figured it out. Was it that they didn't have a good training data set to get started, or is that not quite the right way to look at this?
So that's interesting, right? Because when the gender shades work that you reference, Joy had created a more representative parliamentary benchmark, and that's where we tested the different commercial gender classification systems to see how well they did for people of different skin tones. And we saw that many of the publicly available training data sets had overwhelmingly lighter skinned people and overwhelmingly male. But in this Google case, it's interesting because if I remember correctly, Jonathan's blog post was talking about the fact that they made equally high error rates for white people too. It's just that the errors that were done for white people were not as egregious and as offensive, right? So that's where I think this is a different, but a very equally important issue.
Interesting. We use the example, if I recommend a different product that you might want to buy and you don't want it, no big deal. If I'm doing cancer diagnostic, that's quite high stakes. This is another lens into that, which is a different type of repercussions. But once again, if you don't get it right, the ramifications to a business that gets it wrong is significant.
Yes, exactly. That's exactly what I was trying to say.
Now, you mentioned Joy, and she was a research partner. She's out of MIT. Tell us a little bit about Joy and the work you guys were doing.
Joy Bowamini is a graduate student at MIT Media Lab, and I emailed her in 2015, I believe, because I was so interested in the work that she was doing. And so by then, she had already started to talk about the types of biases that she was seeing in open source face recognition systems. So she was just working in some art project and she was trying to have this OpenCV face detection library detect her face. And she found that it wouldn't detect her face. It would detect, you know, her friend's face. And then she eventually realized that every time she puts on a white mask, then it would detect her face. I think it was a very effective way to show people what kinds of issues we were dealing with, right? And I think this is why what really makes Joy unique is that she's not only a great researcher, but she's also an artist and she's also a very good communicator. So she has these really good ways of making a point and making sure that her work is very impactful. So she was already working on this and I advised her on her master's thesis, which was taking a deep dive into this issue and systematically sort of quantifying the problem. So sure, it's one thing to say that this doesn't work on you or on a couple of other people, but how do you do a systematic study, gather a data set, present the results to show that this is a systemic issue?
And you referenced the parliamentarian. Was this where she was getting the faces from government officials?
Yes. So the question was, if we wanted to test how well these systems did on people of different skin tones and different genders. And so we just chose these two because, you know, we wanted to constrain the problem, but I'm sure but this is just to show that there is an issue, right? And so the question was, since the data sets that were already available were not representative of the world, basically, how do we come up with a data set that has a variation of skin tones and genders? And so what she did was she went to first see which parliaments in the world have a high representation of women. And then out of those, pick the countries with two extremes and what we call the Fitzpatrick skin tone classification system. So the darkest and the lightest to do a comparison. And then also these photos of parliamentarians are they're taken under very highly constrained scenarios. So they're not very difficult. They don't have different poses. They're all looking at the camera. So you can kind of extract out some of the other problems just specifically to study the effect of skin tone and gender. Yes. And so this data set was collected. And after that, we evaluated the results of three different commercial gender classification systems.
So I actually see this then as both a technical problem, both the data, the breadth of the data, which then would hopefully yield this unbiased algorithm, but also a staffing problem and the need for a diverse staff who brings that mindset to this technical problem. So what do you see as really the solution going forward? How should companies attack this issue of bias?
I see the root of the problem being the lack of diversity in this entire field, and not just by race and gender, because you can have people of a particular race or gender who still wouldn't work on this problem or still wouldn't identify this problem. You need to have the people who are working on this kind of problem. So, but the thing is, like, imagine if face recognition was developed in the continent of Africa, then this is, you know, we wouldn't have face recognition systems that have really high error rates for darker skinned people, right? So, you know, I mean, and so at the root of the problem is, I think, you know, the concentration of wealth, power, data sets, and companies, and who's working on artificial intelligence in general, and what problems are seen as important.
Another question then, how far do you think this technology should go? There's things I'm reading now. I can't even tell if it's real or not, or it just becomes a meme, but somebody argued they could look at faces and determine sexual preference or understanding emotions. Clearly, you know, we're at the cusp of perhaps more challenges that are going to drive you nuts.
So the problem is, if your conclusion was that given the profile image of someone, I can predict with X percent accuracy whether they are gay or not. Maybe I might take that result, because the way you present yourself, is, if you're openly gay, would be different from the way you present yourself if you're not openly gay. But what they're claiming is that it's basically the overall conclusion that they're making is, say I'm just walking around the street and I haven't told anybody that I'm of my sexual orientation, and some surveillance camera takes a picture of me. They're saying that you can with high probability determine whether my sexual orientation. This is not backed by the work that they did. And also another thing that they say is that the work that they did gives evidence that the reason that people are, that their sexual orientation is, I think like there's some hormonal theory or something like that, that determines someone's sexual orientation. Now, the danger here is they've done, in my opinion, pseudoscience. Right. Which is not rigorous, but sensational. So it's making all the headlines and it's gotten all these papers. And also something that's dangerous. Not only have they done pseudoscience that's inaccurate, they've told now some repressive governments that if you have some random classification system and it classifies me as, you know, gay, then that's probably accurate. You know, it's such a combination of things that's awful.
Is this, and this is something I've been reading about recently, is this the curse of dimensionality? Does that term ring for you? Is that, and maybe having you define it is better than having me define it, or is that, you know, you can always find correlations in a large enough data set, and it's not likely to be correct. You need to do more work. You need to do more data science. You
it's
need
not causality, it. Basically. It's that, you know, if you told me there is an association between someone's profile picture and whether or not they were openly gay, I would probably believe that. If they might, you know, there might be a difference in the way people are present themselves in their profile pictures, depending on whether they're openly gay or not.
It may be no different than someone saying, showing their profile picture walking with a baby in their hand to show I'm a family person, right? I bet it's a similar thing. And whatever you put in a profile picture has lots of driving factors towards what you're choosing, right?
Exactly. And so when you come up with something with a conclusion that can harm so many people, you have to do a very rigorous science. You can't just do, you know, find associations in the data and then come up with conclusions that are stretches. And I think the author, Michael Kaczynski, says that, I mean, one of the authors, the most senior author, says that the reason he wanted to do this is he wanted to show the danger that this is possible. That's what he said. But maybe that's true. But the thing is that, like, what you're telling, I think what they did is much more dangerous, because what you're telling them now is that you can accurately do this, which you can't even.
Which you can't.
So somebody's going to try, like, say I walk around somewhere and somebody's going to try to tell me you are homosexual, and I can tell, right? And I'm going to arrest you for it. You know what I mean?
Right. So this issue of do no harm, you're exactly right. People hadn't really thought about the implication. Obviously, there are implications of getting a cancer diagnosis wrong versus a shopping reference. And this is even a more an equally powerful do no harm that's slightly orthogonal than a cancer diagnosis. So we could go a whole podcast on what was done here, but I'd love to get your sense then. There was a piece of work that you were part of in terms of Google Street View images of cars that got correlated with voting districts. And, you know, I'm not sure I really want to know what car a Republican drives or what a Democrat drives, but I'm nervous as I read that and hearing you now, it makes me more nervous. These seem like unhealthy data points in an already polarized society. So what's your sense of that analysis?
You know, that's exactly sort of why I wanted to do a deeper dive into ethical considerations of artificial intelligence and bias and things like that, because my work suffers from some of these things. It is very dangerous to come to conclude. So one of the things, for example, we do is we show the correlation between crime rates and certain types of cars in a zip code, in a particular zip code. And if I went back to do this work again, I would have been very careful about that, because once again, we use historical crime rate data. And now I don't want, you know, some police department to go and say, hey, this zip code has a lot of vans, and so let's send more police there, right? What I'm very excited about in terms of that work is some of its potential implications for gathering surveys in places that it's very difficult to get data about constituents. So, for example, you know, even in the US, census is a very cumbersome thing. It takes a lot of money. And even it's a very political and contentious matter, because people use it for redistricting. And Dana Boyd, who's like an expert in this, was telling me that, for example, the 2020 census is going to be very contentious, because one of the things that is being done is undercounting Latino populations. Mm-hmm. You know, with various questions that are being added and things like this to make sure that certain people don't answer them. But what if we could have an alternative, you know, way of guessing the number, the population of a particular place using publicly available data, and we could compare that to the census that is gathered by the data set.
That's a way to validate.
Those kinds of applications I would be excited about. But what if, so the Canadian Research Institution, and they are looking at the relationship between greenery and population health. So like, they're not just that, but the problems that you might have because of pollution. And it's a long-term study. And so they're using Google Street View to do this. I'm involved in a project to quantify what's called spatial apartheid in South Africa using images. And so those kinds of things I'm excited about. And also, imagine doing a census in places where it's very difficult and very time and labor intensive and money. It takes a lot of resources to do surveys, right? So what if I want to know which states have a lot of schools, a high density of schools, very easily? What if I want to know, people do a lot of stuff about soil health. You know, they use satellite imagery to analyze soil health. So there, I think, you know, there are a lot of applications that I'm, that I think would be very interesting and very impactful, using this work. But then at the same time, like you mentioned, there are also applications that are, you know, kind of dangerous. So do we want more political targeting? Do we want, you know, the people who are most interested in my work seemed to be bankers and banks and insurance companies.
Sure.
And, you know, yeah, then do I want them to use this information more?
So let me just close on this. I think this is really interesting on the really broader, the broader thinking you want us all to have as we begin to leverage AI more and more in our solutions. So I guess, giving everything we've talked about, you know, what advice would you have for business leaders today? What do you want them to do as they go about their next project?
I would like them to, so I'm very happy that I have my hardware background. When I first started working in AI, I kind of, sometimes I wished that I was one of these people who's been doing it since I was 15 or something like that, you know? But, and I was just like, I didn't know how my electrical engineering or analog circuit design, whatever background would impact it. I worked at Apple for a number of years in product development, not as a PhD researcher. And really the number one thing that it impacts is my way of thinking of process and what kind of process needs to be put in place when people are working on AI, when they're applying it to their domain. Right now it seems like there's a rush and everybody just wants to use machine learning for everything. And so one is just think, is it appropriate for you, or do you need to use machine learning for this domain? And secondly, if you're going to use it, what process do you have in place to do extensive testing, to check for biases, to, and then even once you deploy it, to continuously monitor it and make changes as necessary. And don't just, don't be in a rush to deploy something. And also provide a lot of documentation, especially if you're going to have APIs, because the main thing we noticed in the gender shades work was that none of these commercial APIs had any guidelines for use cases or how to interpret the, you know, results that you had and what kinds of scenarios you should use these things for and you should not use these things for. And so I encourage all commercial entities to provide lots of documentation and guidelines for their users.
Perfect. Timnit Jebru, what fantastic points to leave our audience with. This was such an incredibly fascinating discussion. You've actually helped me and all of us, I think a little differently about the impact of the work that we do and expanded our, you know, taken our blinders off in terms of really getting this right. So I just want to thank you so much for taking the time to be with us. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you.